Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Thank you all for listening to this podcast. Let me invite you to join our MS forums. We have over 1,000 active members discussing common themes and sharing their experience on living with multiple sclerosis. Please consider joining. You can find the link to the MS News Today forums in this episode's description. Welcome to the Multiple Sclerosis News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Megan Beer. Dr. Beer is a rehabilitation neuropsychologist in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Johns Hopkins. She is a nationally recognized expert on the mood and cognition symptoms common to multiple sclerosis. Dr. Beer is also the founder of Find Empathy, an online directory and educational platform that helps connect people with chronic medical conditions to therapists who understand their diagnosis. Dr. Beer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's definitely wonderful to have you. And Dr. Beer, you are a neuropsychologist. Can you explain to our listeners what that means?
Sure, absolutely. I often tell people when I introduce myself that that basically means that I work with people who have concerns about their thinking skills like memory and attention, or have concerns about emotional symptoms like feeling overwhelmed, having depression, feeling anxious, or maybe just feeling irritable sometimes. And it could be that they have symptoms of both emotion and cognitive symptoms, or they just have one or the other. If it's just emotional symptoms, it's usually people who are living with a chronic illness or a neurologic condition, and how emotional symptoms may have resulted because of that diagnosis. So that's essentially what it means to be a neuropsychologist and kind of how I view my work with people.
I appreciate the clarity. Thank you. As someone with secondary progressive multiple sclerosis, I have had frustrating experiences with a myriad of emotions, and sometimes it's difficult to distinguish if they are from our disease, such as pseudobulbar affect, or if they are a product of our environment or everyday stressors. There's so many things.
Right. And even that, it sometimes is difficult to sort of parcel out what symptoms are coming from MS itself, or the neurologic condition that somebody has, what symptoms are coming from. It's challenging to live with any chronic illness, especially something like multiple sclerosis, where there's a lot of uncertainty. And then what's just real life, you know, there's usually some interaction between all of those. But it is sometimes helpful to talk about that things like in MS, depression and anxiety are more common. And that may be because of the illness itself. We know now more than ever that depression and anxiety are symptoms of having multiple sclerosis. They're not just a reaction, oh, gee, it's hard to live with MS. But there's that as well. You know, we all have those moments of grief or uncertainty of living with MS. And that's just real life, right? Anybody that would have any sort of challenging event come up or a new symptom that arises might have some worry or anxiety around it. And so how do you manage the susceptibility to anxiety and depression because of having this neurologic condition, as well as the normal emotions of uncertainty and frustration that arise with the challenges of this diagnosis?
I think that's very validating to hear, especially for our listeners who are experiencing challenges that perhaps they feel are new or out of their comfort zone or what they're not used to. Are you saying that there actually are physiological reasons why we may experience these emotional variances?
Yes, absolutely. There's quite a bit of research now that's showing that having MS makes somebody more susceptible to symptoms of anxiety and depression. And just on the surface, one thing that led to more research going down this pathway is that we know that people with multiple sclerosis have higher rates of anxiety and depression than even people with terminal illness. So people started questioning that, like, hey, there must be more to this story than just, gee, it's hard to live with MS. And so there's been quite a bit of research that has looked at the role that inflammation might play, or where lesions are located, or maybe even genetic factors that could play a role. And there's evidence for all of those pieces and lots of good researchers that are doing more in this area.
I'm grateful to hear that we're researching the confluence of factors that may contribute to our emotional health. What led you toward this profession, more specifically, specializing in multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't have any personal experience. I think often when I'm asked that question, maybe an underlying subtext is, you know, do you have a family member or a good friend that had this? I actually started off working with traumatic brain injury. So even before I went to grad school, I worked in a place called Bancroft Neurohealth as a direct care worker. So I would often take people to doctor's appointments or help with medication management for people with severe traumatic brain injuries. And I loved the people that I worked with. They're amazing human beings. And I thought to myself, you know, I would love to be able to do even more. And so I decided to go back to grad school with the full intention of going into working with people that have traumatic brain injury. And in my second year of graduate school, one of my professors who ran the neuropsychology program at the TNEC MS Center in New Jersey asked if there was anybody in our class who was interested in doing a clinical externship with him. And at the time, I was just trying to get as much experience as I could. And I went to work with him 2 days a week and absolutely loved it. You know, and one of the things that really drew me to working with MS is that for better or worse, at that time, there was really not a lot of research about mood and cognitive symptoms in people living with multiple sclerosis. And there was a lot of research in areas like stroke and brain injury and other populations. And so one thing that drew me there was, you know, is there something that we know from these other individuals who have been studied for such a long time that we could take treatments and apply them in MS and help to make people's lives better? And so it was sort of I saw this big gap, not only in research, but also from the clinical side, and that there wasn't a lot of even psychologists or mental health providers who were focusing their attention on MS at the time. And to me, it just sort of felt like a calling, like there's work to be done here to help people live their best lives possible.
Well, I can definitely concur with the need, and we're very grateful to have your expertise. As someone who does experience symptoms of multiple sclerosis that affect my emotional well-being, it can be a challenge to both confront what we're dealing with and then how to best cope with them and problem solve, because they do approach us at different levels throughout our disease. You do bring to light that, you know, you educate, you work in the lab, and you see patients. Mm-hmm. That must lend to a great deal of perspective to your purview of how this affects patients.
Yeah, you know, I will tell you that the work with people, my work with people is the primary place that I learn. And, you know, I do a lot of work with an organization called Can Do Multiple Sclerosis, and I often end in-person conversations by saying that I love coming to those groups, and I feel like I learn as much as everybody else there, because I'm always hearing new strategies that people are using and learning. And so many times my work with people in the clinic and through work like with Can Do Multiple Sclerosis or the National MS Society, that gives ideas and thoughts and questions that then inform much of the research that I do or that the groups of people that I work with do. And so, you know, I would say there is definitely some synergy between those three things. But I would say the majority of my work comes from learning from people who are living with this condition day in and day out.
And I would like to let our listeners know that Can Do MS provides educational programs for people living with multiple sclerosis and their families. It's a wonderful resource, and I have watched you speak on their webinars, and I encourage people to check them out because they're a wonderful source of education and comfort for many people and their families who live with multiple sclerosis.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite organizations. The people who run it are just fabulous, really are doing it for all the right reasons. And it's really a great resource for people who are looking to connect with others or just to learn more about MS.
Absolutely. In looking at emotional dysfunction, for lack of a better word, that I would say emotional capitulation, just what we go through on an everyday basis. With multiple sclerosis, we tend to grieve a lot continually, either a loss or a loss of an ability, a memory, or we're not feeling ourselves. I find the grief cycle seems to be a continuum. Just when you think you've resolved something, you're on to something else. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that in people with multiple sclerosis? And what do you advise?
Absolutely, 100%. You know, with MS, one of the main things that I start with early on in my work with people is getting comfortable with uncomfortable emotions, for lack of a better way of saying it. Many times I tell people, you know, I think there's this expectation that when you go to work with a psychologist or a mental health provider, they're going to help you get rid of all the emotions that you don't want. And the reality is that it is challenging to live with a chronic illness like MS, and it is normal to feel grief and to feel frustrated and to feel annoyed by things that are just kind of a day-to-day thing. Like, it's more challenging for me to pick up my coffee mug today, or I really wanted to do this activity this afternoon and I'm just feeling really wiped. My fatigue is acting up. To I have a major change in function that is impacting how I saw my life going. And so one of the things that I work with people on is visiting those emotions. Not accepting them in the sense that I feel okay that, you know, that these things are happening, but inviting them in to examine them, being aware of them and where they're coming from, naming the emotions, kind of identifying why you're feeling that way in that moment, but also not living there continuously, right? Where it becomes problematic is, I think, when people get stuck or there's a type of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy, where we think of fusion, where you get fused with those thoughts, where you get stuck in them, when you get mired in them and you can't see anything outside of them. It's healthy to feel those things, let them be there for a little bit, and then switch your attention to something else. It becomes a little bit more unhealthy, and it may be helpful to work with the mental health provider if you can't see anything else except those emotions. So one thing that I talk to people a lot about is that, you know, we don't want to push those emotions away to the point of kind of burying them under the rug, but we also don't want to live there. So how do you walk that tightrope? And it can be challenging at times, but there's lots of different strategies that you can use to feel the grief, but then also move forward with your life.
I very much like that you are helping people hold both, if you will, or many things, and give them permission to feel that feeling.
Yeah.
I think so often we have guilt around feeling these emotions, and we should be more positive or grateful. And we may be positive and grateful, but we're also grieving. And I think it's very powerful to treat ourselves kindly in that process and allow all those feelings to be valid. And like you said, help ourselves not get mired, but at the same time, accept them for what they are, because they're very much a reality with multiple sclerosis.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Would you illuminate pseudobulbar effect? I know this is very elusive for many living with multiple sclerosis. They may not have heard of it, but they may be dealing with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So pseudobulbar affect is not overly common, but it's not uncommon in MS. And so I think about it as a mismatch between the way you feel and your outward affect, or the way that you are being perceived by others, or kind of your actions. So what that means is, inside I might feel happy, and outside I'm crying, or outside I'm laughing and inside I'm feeling grief, or maybe inside I'm feeling nothing, or I'm feeling pretty neutral, but I'm laughing hysterically, or I'm crying uncontrollably, or I'm having kind of switches between my affect. So it's basically this mismatch between how your emotions are being portrayed on the outside versus how you feel on the inside. And the thing that I would say is that it is really important to bring this up if you even have an inkling that maybe this is going on for you with your neurologist, because there are FDA-approved treatments for pseudobulbar affect at this point. And so there is quite a bit that can be done around it. But there, you know, as I think you mentioned, there's sometimes a lot of grief or shame around those emotions that, you know, people kind of don't understand them. And maybe sometimes they even think they're, quote, going crazy, end quote, you know, when it's really just kind of another neurologic symptom that does have some treatments. And even sometimes family members don't understand it. So if it can be explained or discussed with your MS provider or neurologist, there's a lot that can be done, and a lot of that mystery and discomfort around it, that shame that can sometimes be brought up, can also be dispelled as well.
Absolutely. And it being Mental Health Awareness Month, it's very important to have that dialogue with your neurologist so you can treat your total self and know that your cognition and your mental health are paramount and equal to your physical health. It's a synergistic reality that we all have to balance.
Right. Yeah. There's a physical therapist that I work with who said, and I love this, she said, you can't disconnect your brain from your body, right? There's an interaction there. So it's very important to pay attention to both.
I really like that. Although sometimes we feel disconnected, we have to treat them together and know that they work together. They complement one another.
Right.
You spoke of family members, and so often is the case, especially with matters of mental and emotional health. It can be difficult to talk to our family about that or help them understand where we are with our disease or our feelings. What do you recommend to our listeners as a good starting point?
Yeah, it's a big question, because I think a lot of it's very individual between the family member and the person living with MS and maybe what the challenges are. I would start with communication, understanding what that person is feeling or thinking, and then going from there. So if it's a lack of education because they don't really get it, or they don't really understand the symptoms that you're having. I hear that a lot, that family members don't really understand the symptoms that I'm having because a lot of them are invisible. I think education is a great starting point. So if they are willing, going to a neurologist visit so that they can ask their questions and hear from the neurologist. Again, any kind of like CanDo MS is a great organization for this as well, because they have a huge focus on support partners and family members. And there was recently at one of the group events, a family member who said, I know my wife experienced fatigue, but it wasn't until I sat in this group and listened to everyone else talk about fatigue that it really hit me that this is different than the fatigue that I feel. And so even though he had been living with his wife and was very open and they had a great relationship, it didn't really hit home to him what that meant until he heard a whole group of other people talking about it. So I think that, support groups or things like CanDo MS or the National MS Society, where family members can get exposure to other people living with MS as well as other support partners, and family members, that can be a really good starting point. If the person is not willing to do that, but they are willing to work with a mental health provider, I do think that sometimes I work with a lot of family members working with a mental health provider to sort of figure out how the couple can communicate together, or the parent or sibling or, you know, whoever the family member is can communicate better. That's really helpful as well. If the person is totally unwilling to go down any of those pathways, that's a harder conversation, and it might be worth the person with MS sitting with a mental health provider and brainstorming some ideas for how to open that door up a little bit more.
I appreciate the depth of your answer, because that was a big question, but thank you so much. I think it lends perspective to the myriad of difficult phases we may be in with any number of our family members. And for our listeners, we will have Dr. Beer's information. I wanted to ask you about cognitive rehabilitation. You worked a lot with people who have had traumatic brain injury. Did you see similarities in some of those individuals with people with multiple sclerosis?
There are some similarities, but there's a lot of differences. I would say that the areas where there are similarities, and maybe it's helpful for me just to summarize some of the cognitive symptoms that people with MS tend to experience. Most commonly, we see that people have difficulty with processing information quickly or efficiently. So that doesn't mean that they can't do it. It doesn't mean that their IQ has changed. It just means that if it used to take me a minute to write an email, maybe now it's taking me 2 or 3 minutes or even 5 minutes to write the same email. It can get done, but it is taking longer. Sometimes I'm seeing things like word finding difficulties. I hear that from almost everybody, that they have challenges around getting their words out, or maybe they jumble words. We are seeing challenges with things like executive functioning, planning, organizing, problem solving, your initiation. So I know I need to do this thing, but I can't quite get myself to get up and go. So those are kind of the things that I see commonly with MS. Also, when we think about memory challenges, many times it's in the learning phase. So many times people with MS can remember just as well as others, even though they don't feel like it, but it's more on the learning phase. So they might need to be exposed to information more than once or several times in order for their brain to really capture it and put that information into long-term memory. So in brain injury, it's a little bit different. It's, you know, sometimes it depends on where the person is injured or the severity. There's often a lot more behavioral things that come up with brain injury that aren't there for most people with MS.
I appreciate that difference, the explanation. And even in my speech just now, I would like to let people know that I have trouble with speech, with dysphagia, and I stutter now and stammer, and I scan for words. So even though it's there, it does take longer for me to find the words. It mm-hmm. also is a writer and an avid reader. It takes longer for me to think of words to put down and comprehend a page, but I encourage people to learn how to adapt because it is not anything to get down on yourself for. It's a natural occurrence of this disease, and it's something we're here to work together to help you feel better about.
Absolutely.
In goal setting, because I noticed with procrastination can also be very difficult in people, in everybody, frankly.
Sure.
Can you explain how goal setting can be more difficult for people with multiple sclerosis and what people can do to maybe start in their ability to set and maintain goals?
Sure. I think the unpredictability of MS is a big reason that goal setting is challenging. So if you feel different day by day, so some days I'm having more pain and other days I'm not, or some days I feel more fatigued and other days I have more energy, that's really challenging because you don't know what each day is going to bring. So it's even harder to try and set a goal and stick to that goal. So I think with goal setting around MS, a lot of times what I'm working on are how do you set a reasonable goal, a manageable goal, and I'll get into that a little bit more, and then how do you also have some flexibility around that goal? So one thing I really like to fall back on is some work from a researcher out at Stanford. His name is BJ Fogg, F-O-G-G. He does work called Tiny Habits. And what I love about this is I think it's good for everybody, but especially for people with MS. And sometimes the starting point is just figuring out how do I fit this new goal into my life and not necessarily I need to dive into the goal right away. So for example, you know, if somebody was wanting to do more stretching or more exercise, first, you have to figure out when can I do this goal reliably. So the goal might be I'm just going to put on my my shoes, the shoes that I'm going to wear, or my workout outfit, or I'm just going to go sit in the place that I'm going to do this exercise every day for a week. And not even do any exercise, not do anything, but just try to see whether fitting it in at the time that you want to do it is actually going to happen, right? Because if you can't wake yourself up at 6 a.m. when you said you were going to do this, the goal is not going to happen, whether you have the motivation or not. If you're so exhausted by nighttime and you're trying to do your goal at that time, and you can't even put your shoes on at that point, then the likelihood that you're going to do the goal is not going to happen, right? So if you can reliably go sit in the place you're going to do your stretching or put on your walking shoes at that time, and that works for a week or two, then you can kind of amp the goal up to, okay, I'm going to do this for 1 minute, you know, a couple times a week or every day for a week and see if that works. And so if by the, I think those pieces sort of help you figure out, will this actually even fit into my life? And if not, let me do some problem solving around it because maybe this is not the right goal to work on, or maybe I need a different goal or I need to do it at a different time. So that's what I would think about for MS. And I think it's good for all of us, but especially for MS.
Thank you so much. I very much like how the first step is seeing if that goal will even fit in to what we can achieve, because so often our goal sets are so far off, we're not taking that first step.
Right.
And I like that. I will let our listeners know I did watch a video where you suggested people just put on their sneakers. And that's it. Because if you can do that, then you know you have that time there.
Yeah, exactly. I had one person who just said, you know, I knew that I would get exhausted, but I figured if I just did you know, this person could do push-ups. Again, it's different depending on the person, but I'm just going to do one push-up before I get into bed every day, or one push-up when I wake up every day. And that sort of helped to get it started. And then the goal kind of steamrolled from there. When that became successful, then it could be two push-ups, or it could, you know, and this can apply to lots of other things, right? I mean, it can be with diet, it can be with goal setting around work or family life. It's whatever it is that you want to incorporate. What's the tiniest version of that that you can think of and try to fit that in? And if that doesn't work, then reevaluate the goal before you kind of beat yourself up for not being successful. And the idea is the more successful you are, the more likely you are to keep doing it. And the more likely you are to keep doing it, the more likely you can grow that goal over time.
And that makes me smile, because I think setting ourselves up for success is half the battle, and realizing that our limitations don't necessarily hold us back from achieving a goal, but shifting how we achieve that goal is equally as important as the goal itself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, it's been such a delight to have you, Dr. Beer. I look forward to having people reach out to you. Can you let people know where they can reach out to you?
Sure, absolutely. So
more about you.
Absolutely. You can be found on Twitter, although I'm not super active, at Megan Beyer, PhD. On my Johns Hopkins website, and I can provide that link because it's kind of long. If you want to see the work that I'm doing at Johns Hopkins, I also have a website, meganbeyer.com, and I'm also working on growing a directory of mental health providers who understand MS as well as other chronic illnesses. And that website is findempathy.com. It's still in the beginning stages, but I think we'll be growing over the next year or two. So keep checking back in there if you're looking for a mental health provider who understands MS or any other chronic illness.
Thank you. And we will make sure to have your contact information in our description as well, Dr. Beer.
Absolutely.
And if I may ask, what message would you like to leave with our listeners today? It's been such a joy to speak with you.
Absolutely. You know, I think I'll kind of hold that line that I said earlier, which is, I really want people to know that it's okay to experience sometimes unpleasant emotions, you know, and, but you also don't have to live there. You know, one thing that I say to myself, and that I think a lot of people that I've worked with over time have kind of incorporated into their own life is a statement of, I won't always feel this way. So even if it has to be an emotion or fatigue or chronic pain, you know, there is some variability in the way that we feel. And sometimes we get so trapped in the emotion at the time that we start to feel hopeless about the future. But I think if we can take, you know, each moment at a time, each day at a time, and say, you know, things, the only, hold on, let me just rephrase that. The only reliable thing is change, right? We for better or worse, there tomorrow will be different. And so if we can keep looking forward, we can all be successful. And that there are lots of supports out there. So whether that's working with a support group, working with a mental health provider, working with an organization like Can Do or the MS Society, there's lots of great resources. And I hope that nobody ever feels like they're going it alone.
I can't think of better words to close with. And Dr. Beer, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you to all of our listeners at Multiple Sclerosis News Today. Take a listen to our podcast at msnewstoday.com. share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com.